Welcome to Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore deep self-awareness, bold curiosity, and passionate advocacy for both ourselves and our communities. Some voices you'll recognize, others will remain a mystery, but they all share one thing: the courage to be seen and heard by speaking up about what matters most to them. Now, my goal for this show is threefold. I want to hold space, ask the big and tough questions, and ultimately amplify the voices that need it most.
I'm calling this inaugural season of the podcast the Tragic Optimist Tour, inspired by the teachings and philosophies of Viktor Frankl, who was, among other things, an author, a poet, a philosopher, and a Holocaust survivor. This season as a whole is part literal and part metaphorical journey. The mission of the Tragic Optimist Tour was to connect in person with as many clients, collaborators, and community members as I could inside a 30-day period. This anxious adventure prioritized small and local in every sense, from lodging to meals to spending quality time with those I care about and engaging in mutual support. This concept of tragic optimism, as I mentioned, was introduced by Viktor Frankl, and it acknowledges that joy and pain must coexist, that pushing forward through the muck is worth it, even when it feels impossible. And maybe there's something that can be learned from it, some special meaning in all the madness. Like many others, I was and still am craving human connection and community. I'm also feeling a lot of fear and uncertainty about the state of this country and the world at large. I wanted to challenge myself to expand the boundaries of my comfort zone, utilize my privileges and resources to make a positive impact, and ultimately bear witness to places and people I'd only ever encountered from behind a screen.
What I discovered was equal parts beauty and terror, joy and pain. Truly the definition of tragic optimism. The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. Hey, weirdos and queerdos, and welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential. I am your host, Maggie Green, and I'm here to remind you that your voice matters and your stories are safe here.
In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings. All guests have a chance to review the material before it is published, so they can be assured that their voices and stories are held and shared with care, treated as sacred things to preserve and pass on. You can find more details about each guest and relevant resources in the show notes for each episode.
As a reminder also, guests have the option to remain anonymous if that is something that helps make them feel safe. It just so happens that for Season 1, The Tragic Optimist Tour, all guests have chosen to share their identities, which I consider a really generous gift. I want to thank all of them for their participation. They're entrusting me with some of their most intimate personal details. So thank you. I'm incredibly grateful for that. Today's guest uses she, her pronouns, identifies as a proud Appalachian, and has a diverse career trajectory that has touched multiple industries, including public service. Her name is Ashley.
Ashley, thank you for being here. I am absolutely thrilled to be sharing this time and space with you. I'd love to invite you to introduce yourself, take a few moments to share with listeners who you are.
Hi there. So my name's Ashley. I originally arrived in Appalachia probably around 2002. I fell in love with the region and really never left. I tried to leave for a while and it was weird being a flatlander again. So I came back to the mountains and here I am. I'm in the northern part of Appalachia these days, still fighting the good fight.
Fighting the good fight. I hear you on that for sure. So Appalachia, for listeners maybe who don't know, I think we got an opportunity to call something out here, like the pronunciation of the term. The easiest way to know whether someone hails from that area or doesn't is the way in which they say that word. So it's music to my ears as a fellow Appalachian. I think everyone knows by at this point I'm from Kentucky. It's where we met, Central Kentucky, the capital city of Frankfort, way back in mid-2000s. Proud to have you here, proud of Appalachia, and I'm really excited that that's something we share as well. As we're thinking about the concept of self-awareness, right, heading into our first segment known as the mirror, actually, your identity as a public servant, I thought maybe we would start there. Like, what does that mean to you? How has it changed over the years? And is that something you identify with still today?
Early on, I had a whole family before me of public servants. My uncle worked for the state of Kentucky as a public servant. My aunt was a school teacher. My grandmother worked for the university in Richmond, Kentucky, and my grandfather was a college professor. And then on my dad's side, my grandfather was a state patrolman and my grandmother was a nurse. So I just saw it in me to kind of carry on that family legacy of serving people. I had some jobs early on in high school, your typical grocery store jobs. And I kind of thought, why am I doing this? Why am I working to make somebody else richer? Yeah, I figured out kind of the magic of capitalism was dead. So I decided to go into public service. I wanted to help people. I wanted to be that person that wasn't there when I was a kid. So I've been a public servant for roughly 20 years going on now, but you know, things have changed. When I became a public servant, it was back in the day when people cherished park rangers and thought that they were the most magical people ever. And kind of going into what we are now, we've been demonized and given sides and removed from our agency's work. And it's different now. I've been through multiple presidential administrations and watched how things kind of ebb and flow. And things have ebbed, but they've not flowed in this administration.
I am curious. I wonder if listeners might be interested as well. Like, public service is a really big space, right? We're talking, there's like local level, state level, federal level. Have you had experiences in all three of those or some of those?
Yes.
Are you seeing the same things happen? Like, in retrospect, obviously things are different now, right?
Right.
Differences kind of between those levels or among those levels. Does that change your perspective?
When I started my public service career, I started out in state government and I loved it. It was some of the best people I've worked with, but it didn't pay anything. Like, it was not the kind of salary to raise a family on, much less my own self. I've worked in state, county, city, and federal. And federal government has been, I thought that I would be at the top of my game because the federal government hires the best of the best. But it's not been that. I think I was the most happiest at the state. I felt that I made the biggest difference on the ground.
You referenced capitalism, so let's talk a little bit about that. As you were sharing, one of the things that comes to mind is this concept of loyalty. Clearly, you entered the field with the desire to help people, which is what public service is all about. loyal to the people, the community, the people on the ground. And now, as I'm sure others have observed, there's this very clear loyalty to the dollar. And when I hear you say, you know, at the state level, not making enough to sustain yourself, you know, make a living. At the federal level, there's this promise and hope that things will be different in that regard. But you find that that's not true, right? The money is fucking there. So, yeah, maybe there's some space for you to vent here, if you have other thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, ever since the Republicans decided they wanted to get pissy about the budget, we don't ever have a budget. We don't ever know what's going on. You know, the federal government is not a business. The federal government is there to provide a benefit for everybody. And all governments are.
Yeah. You know? So kind of going back to this idea of loyalty, it's very clear where and how that manifests in these agencies and departments and institutions that are responsible for our welfare and care and well-being. Where does your loyalty lie? Who or what are you most passionate about?
It's been an interesting tightrope because often what is right isn't what the regs prefer. Or rather, if you do the right thing, it's not the politically correct thing. But I had a gentleman years ago say that he would rather take a hard right than an easy left. And that stuck with me over the years, that sometimes the easiest way to, you know, the way that is right, the way that, you know, our citizens deserve, and these are the people that place this trust in us. A lot of people place their trust in politicians and political parties saying, oh my God, please get this done for us. And it's the politicians, if I can just be honest, they don't do shit. It's the people on the ground, the day in, the day out, the merit government employees, the civil service employees that make it happen. And it's very hard for us to perform our jobs when we are constantly under threat. For example, there is a Supreme Court case being held right now, preventing a lot of layoffs in one department of the government. And if that goes through, then thousands of people lose their jobs. When I started doing this work 20 years ago, I was the youngin' in the room. I just was there to listen and observe while the old timers talked and drank and did whatever they did after hours, because that was how you earned your dues. And you know, that doesn't really go on anymore, but I realize that now I'm the oldest person in the room. Layoffs, retirements, buyouts, all of the elders in the agency have left. And while normally that would be a badge of courage, a badge of honor to wear, it terrifies.
Like a last person standing, like who's next on the chopping block? I know that's violent verbiage there, but I mean, it is acts of violence, you know, pulling the rug out from under people, threatening their livelihoods, their future food for their families. You know, I can't help but wonder, like, how do you keep any faith or hope? Like, your heart and your spirit are clearly tied to wanting to make things better for the people, including, like you were suggesting, right? Do what wasn't done for you when you were little. How do you hold on to that? Can you even reconcile that with the current environment?
I'm still working on it.
Do you think about alternatives? Is there anything, maybe fantasies, like as far as career goes or your place in the world even? Like, can you paint a picture of what you see in the future? An ideal future state, what would that look like for you?
Ideally, more government support, more science.
Okay, let's switch gears here, because, you know, public servants are humans, right? You have your work life, then you have your private life. And as This, of course, is a safe space, something that we've talked about a little bit before. Very curious about your experience, if you're open to sharing the dating world in this moment in time.
It's been interesting. So I'm trans. I transitioned 4 years ago. I was a pandemic transition. So I've known like my whole life. I just didn't like do it until the pandemic. And so, you know, I've dated everybody. I've dated guys. I've dated girls. I've dated NBs in between. So, you know, if you're a trans girl and you have like no standards and you just want male attention, Grindr is the place that you go. And so I had, you know, being newly transitioned, I didn't really feel like I had, you know, the looks or anything like that. So I hung out on Grindr a whole lot, like in my first year while I was in transition. And I don't know how many stories you want me to share with you, but I've got some interesting ones. I fucked the president of the anime club of the local university. I didn't realize this until later, but you know, it's been interesting. And I met a boyfriend. I met a boyfriend on Grindr, and we dated for like, I don't know, like 3 months. No, 6 months. And we were like really good. We never fought. And then like, I told him one day I loved him, and that was like too much for him. You know, there's been that. There's been Bumble. There's been Her. And I think I've met the most quality matches on this dating app called Her. It's very trans friendly. You have trans women, trans men, and then, you know, the whole spectrum of feminine. I met a girl on there a few weeks ago, and we're about to go on our third date. So this is like the most dating luck that I've had that has been good for me post-transition.
That's interesting you say luck. Like, I don't know. I've been like perpetually monogamous, serial monogamous for many years. And I guess the online dating experience, like we just missed each other, right? Like I've not ever had that experience. I have a lot of friends who share about what they're seeing happening and making recommendations to each other. So all of this is kind of news to me as far as like the different apps and the experiences there.
Yeah, it's totally different. I mean, when you and I knew each other, I was with one girl long term, and we didn't meet on an app. I think we met in school. And then the girl after that, like we met through a work function. Being up here, you know, brand new where I'm at is just, it's like the only way to meet people. But luckily, like this girl is real old fashioned. Like she's not a big texter. She'd like rather talk to you on the phone. She likes dates and all that other stuff. So we'll see what happens.
I'm definitely excited for you. A few things come to mind as you're sharing like what you've experienced so far as you're transitioning, knowing where we are in this time and space, like trust comes up for me, and also safety. How do you know you're safe? How do you trust another person? Like, are you meeting in public places at first?
That's been the big thing. Like, you know, everybody wants to hook up every now and then. And those have typically left me not feeling safe. So I'm not going to tell your listeners what to do, but it feels, you feel in a certain way afterwards. Or it did for me. There's one guy that I met early on. He's been pretty consistent. Like whenever we meet each other, we were able to do what we need. But I think if I'm going to start dating this girl, like I've tried polyamory before and it wasn't for me, because that's like the running joke that all trans people are poly. And I'm not a jealous person. I'm not that at all. And I tried that when I moved here. But it just wasn't for me. So that's been the other thing that I've been dealing with, is trying to meet another queer person that is monogamous.
I have a feeling you're not alone. You know, personally, I've never tried polyamory, but I've certainly studied on it. You know, like I love any kind of just breaking conventions. You know, like what are the possibilities outside of what we've been taught our whole life?
Relationship anarchy.
Exactly. That is what is appealing to me. Like, don't tell me what the rules are. There are no rules, right? I get to decide.
I've heard of the relationship escalator.
No.
The relationship escalator is like, you know, you're on this thing, and as you reach certain floors, you have to do other things. So we've been together so long. Let's get engaged. Let's get like a puppy together.
Yeah.
Get a house, and then we have kids. And you just go along this relationship escalator because that is what has been programmed into you by, like, modern cishet society. I was very guilty of that with my first marriage. And we, like, after we both kind of stepped back post-divorce and talked about it, yeah, like, it was just like it was a security blanket almost.
Yeah, like what else do you do? Like this is the playbook.
You remember when you and I were neighbors before I moved out into the county?
I mean, who could forget?
That was some of the happiest that I've been in my life, because like all of my friends were around me, I had my community around me, and then like, you know, riding up the relationship escalator, we bought a house out in the county, and then, you know, boom, nobody ever came to visit us. It's nobody's fault, but, you know, why would you go to visit somebody that lives out at the golf course?
Yeah, definitely not centrally located, not a lot of, like, social action happening.
South Frankfort was, like, one of the best communities that I've ever lived in. 6 blocks from the Capitol building, and, like, you could hear people from the Capitol building, like, chanting on a good day if the windows were open. That was such a great time in my life.
Really is a special place. I don't know if I shared as part of the road trip I got to revisit. I hadn't seen a lot of the people in well over a decade. And it was like exactly 1 week post flood, which was, you know, there was like the connection and the love for that place all this time. But then there was in this moment of crisis, seeing everyone come together and support each other and show up was just, I kind of forgot how much I loved Frankfort, South Frankfort specifically.
They are so good at showing up for each other. That was one thing that I loved while I worked there and lived there, was the sense of community that South Frankfort had for each other. We just looked out for each other, and it didn't matter what side of Capitol Street that you lived on.
Right. There really isn't that divisiveness, or if there is, it wasn't obvious to me. Everybody knows your name.
Mm.
Definitely a small town feel. And when I left, when I made the decision to leave, part of that criteria, I'm like, pros and cons. I had never experienced anonymity ever. And that was appealing to me because it was new, right? Like, I'm going to go all the way to the Pacific Northwest. I don't know anyone, have no support network or ties, and just like see what happens and be able to walk down the street and not have somebody all up in my damn business. I feel differently now. Yeah. Tell me about that. How
it's kind of weird because I moved up here to Southern PA after living in West Virginia for so long. And nobody here knows me. I thought that would be a good thing. But I'm lonely. Like, it's incredibly insular in some communities. And it didn't feel that way in Kentucky. And I don't know if it's because I'm in the north or what I am. But people have kind of their way of doing things up here, and you're not in it.
That's exactly what I've observed here. And there's something really special about Kentucky that if you've not ever been there, it's hard to articulate. But even when you've experienced it, it's definitely a cultural thing, right? I'm thinking neighborhoods, like you might not know the person intimately who lives next door to you or across the street, but you can count on a smile and a wave and a hello if you run into each other. If you walk down the sidewalk past someone having a cookout, they're going to offer you a burger. You know, like, and I don't know. Like I said, it's definitely a cultural thing, like no such thing as a stranger kind of vibe. There's an edge to that too. There's definitely like the fringe where like the outward expression is positive and warm and inviting. But like actually underneath, it's more like passive aggression. Like that happens too. We get a lot of passive aggression here in the Pacific Northwest, and it even in driving habits, it is hilarious. Like, people will sit at a four-way stop. Four cars will sit waiting. Like, you make the next move. Like, things like that, like big differences, cultural differences. I fell in love with Kentucky, maybe for the first time, with this most recent visit.
Come to love West Virginia until I moved away. When I first took a job there, and I moved away from Kentucky and everything I'd known there, because I was post-divorced from my first wife and everything in Frankfurt reminded me of her. And I just left for a raise. And then when I moved to West Virginia, I thought, I don't have anything in common with 10% of the people that I meet. And now that I've gone, it's like I realize that I miss it. It's home. And I don't know if that's because that's where my daughter lives or if because that's where I did a lot of like personal development, but really taught me to get off my high horse. So it's just like, so what if these people don't have college degrees? So what if X, Y, and Z isn't true? They're still people.
Right.
They still contribute to our society. And they are what makes part of what this magic is true.
Yeah.
We get this message, and I don't know where the message comes from, because it's a horrible message that these people are throwaway people, and they're not. Like, I'm shifting career paths because I was a public service in the environmental arena for years. And I'm trying out something new. I'm in nursing school right now because I think that coming out of the damage that we're going to be coming out of, that mental health is going to be very important. And so I don't see people as broken. They're simply a product of their environment. The people that are acting out that you see ridiculed in TikToks and ridiculed in Facebook clips, those are people too. They're products of the system that maybe just push them too far. I don't really pay attention to what's going on outside of my region, and that's my own problem. But I feel that as long as I'm in Appalachia, I have a duty to these people. I have a duty to this region. I can't cut and run. This is home. This has been home for me for 20 years. It was a region that took me in after I ran away from the big city at 18, so I didn't like what was going on in the big city, and they took me in. They had no questions, and they just accepted me. And so I feel that this is part of my duty to fix this region, whether it be through public health or through environmental remediation or whatever. I can't quit this region. I've tried. I moved away, and that was before the pandemic, and I hated it because it wasn't home. I went down to the coast and I hated it. I absolutely hated it. Like, it was not my cup of tea. Don't put a mountain girl at the beach.
You mentioned public health, mental health specifically. I think those are both great notes to kind of take us into our final segment about advocacy, aka the megaphone. As you're thinking about the intersection of Appalachian culture and its people and where you're at in your career, transitioning out of environmental protection into medicine, what are some things that you want to scream from the rooftops right now that people most need to hear? Like, how do we advocate for our mental health, our culture, our communities at a time when those things are threatened at every turn?
You have to take care of yourself first. You have to take care of your own mental faculties. And the one thing that I see mentioned in the research over and over again, and those of us in Appalachia, we have an overactive nervous system because we've been through years and years and years of trauma, whether it be industrialized trauma, systemic trauma. You know, we've just been used to getting crapped on for the last century or two. And so we are in a fight or flight. Somatic therapy, that means nature walks, yoga, things like that, things that restore your balance to the earth. Those are so important. And I didn't know this until the last 2 years when I was trying to clean my body from anxiety all the time. We have a beautiful region in front of us. We have the mountains, we have streams. I mean, go out in it, let it heal you, because that's where we're meant to be. Spend some time in nature every day. And also, you know, with the things that are going on with our planet, with the planetary decay and all that, get out there and enjoy it. Like, you're a citizen. You deserve to be here. Enjoy it while we have this.
While we have it, yeah.
We only get one chance at life. Like, you can go through life being pissed off and paranoid, or you can choose to reject that and try to find the joy in everything. Your existence is resistance. Like, don't let these fuckers win. They want us all to be miserable and subservient and in line and controllable.
Yeah, fuck that.
They knew all that until they came to Appalachia, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Because all of these ICE agent wannabes are trained for street warfare. This is mountain warfare out here, baby.
It's a different beast, a different ballgame. Anything else that you want to add, like maybe calls to action? Going out into nature, obviously, prioritizing your mental health. Anything else that you would challenge listeners to do or learn?
I don't want to wear you all out, because I'm sure, I mean, just surviving right now is a thing. But as you're able to, in your own capacity, be politically aware. Be politically active. There's more of us than there are them. You have a voice. Make it be heard. It's your right.
Thank you so much for that important reminder, Ashley. Yes, that we do all have a voice. I think it's our responsibility and privilege to use those voices, to speak up, to speak out, make our stories heard. On that note, this is probably the perfect time to talk a little bit about where we are right now. I'm worried, y'all. No, you know what? I am terrified. Terrified for my trans and gender nonconforming siblings. Kind, hardworking, amazing, and creative folks like Lenny from episode 3 and their wife, Tess in episode 4, Eris, episode 5, Jess in episode 8, and Ashley, who of course you just heard from in this episode. Nearly 1,000 pieces of anti-trans legislation have been introduced so far this year. The actions being taken at the national level to deny the existence of trans people, to eradicate history, to destroy the lives of innocent citizens for daring to be themselves is beyond sickening. And it's only going to get worse before it gets better. I don't have to tell you that. It already has. You know this. From the genocide in Gaza, where aid is literally being blocked from starving families forced to survive in piles of rubble, destruction, to funding cuts for critical social safety and service programs like Medicaid, not to mention the veritable circus of distraction tactics and propaganda pushed down our throats across mass media. It feels like every day is a new horror because it is. So let's remember Ashley's advice. You have to take care of yourself first. Pace yourself. Give yourself space to grieve, but also to gear up. Feel your feelings, process, and refuel. Then get to work. So much of what we're seeing in this country and the world is history repeating itself, and yet we're still here. Unfortunately, so is fascism. Tragic optimism teaches us that we can keep going, find our joy and balance to the earth, as Ashley calls it, and we can still be aware, awake to the atrocities around us. We can take news breaks, and we can limit our time on social media,
and we can be active in day-to-day resistance. Micro-rebellions, as Jess called them, you may remember, challenging family and friends to think more critically, to act. Bearing witness in itself is a political act. Every time you show up to listen and learn from others who are different from you and pass along what you learn to the people around you, we all have a better chance at life. So whoever you are, wherever you are, keep showing up. And please, for the sake of all that is human, protect the dolls.
So a little behind the scenes insight for you, a peek behind the curtain, as it were. Ashley and my conversation for this episode was a bit abbreviated. It didn't last quite as long as I would have liked, and I want to acknowledge how grateful I am for the time that we did get to spend together. And just point out, we encountered a couple of technical issues that happens now and again. And so I just wanted to share about that. And also, you may recall in episode 1, I shared a bit about some of the challenges and unexpected events that happened over the course of the Tragic Optimist tour. One of those was a friend who experienced an injury. That friend was Ashley. I just want to kind of connect the dots there for you. We had a chance to spend time together in person at her home in Pennsylvania. Immediately following her injury, we were able to pick up some medication for her and be of support there while she was recovering. And even all these months later, she's still kind of dealing with that. So thank you, Ashley, for your kindness, for your generosity, and being willing to host me and my travel companion as part of the trip, and for creating time and space for us to have this conversation a couple months down the road. I really admire Ashley's commitment to public service and have been reading a lot of the writing that she's been doing lately. That is one of the ways in which she's coping with everything that's happening at the federal level, everything that's happening in this country, in particular as a trans person, what that experience is like. And so I asked her permission to share a bit more insight about that in the form of her own writing. She was kind enough to grant permission for me to share this piece that I think really speaks deeply to her commitment to public service, the lengths and the extent to which she will go to protect our nation's citizens. In this case, one of her roles in public service was as a volunteer firefighter. So the piece I'm going to read, again with Ashley's permission, is called Staying Power: What I Learned from Saving a Fire Department That Almost Burned Me Out. I've worn a lot of uniforms: park ranger green, mine inspector khaki, the gray-blue of emergency response. But the one that stuck closest to my skin and my heart was the yellow turnout gear of a volunteer firefighter. My name is Ashley. I'm a trans woman, a public servant, and a firefighter who nearly walked away from the service I loved because the culture was killing the people inside it. This is the story of how I stayed, how I helped rebuild a department on the verge of collapse, and why, years later, I'm still fighting for a fire service that doesn't just train its volunteers, but keeps them. Tyler Mountain Volunteer Fire Department had good people, brave people, people who would drag hose through the rain at 3 a.m. and crack jokes while cleaning up biohazard. But behind the scenes, things were fraying. Leadership was toxic, calls were missed, junior firefighters were left unmentored, members walked out in silence. And I stayed until I almost couldn't. When your fire department feels like it's dying from the inside, you start to take that rot personally. I found myself doing twice the work, trying to prove myself in a space that refused to hold itself accountable. I was burning out hard, and the idea of leaving haunted me. If I go, what happens to the next girl like me, the next scared kid, the next broken system that needed fixing? Then the dam broke. A wave of resignations, a leadership scandal, a community that finally said, enough. The old board left. What remained was a skeleton crew, a lot of grief, and an opening to do things differently. That was our shot. We rebuilt policies, we cleaned out lockers and trauma at the same time. We mentored instead of mocked. We trained with intention. We stopped protecting egos and started protecting each other. And slowly, the station breathed again. They leave because they're isolated. They leave because no one checks on them after the hard calls. They leave because the people in charge refuse to change. They leave because they're women, or queer, or too soft, or too loud, or too different, or too human. That's a loss the fire service cannot afford. I've worked in government, science, field ops, and emergency response, and in every role I've come back to this. Public service should be survivable, not just physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. We cannot keep romanticizing burnout. We can't keep mistaking the silence for strength. The legacy I want isn't that I carried the most gear or worked the most hours. It's that I made space for others to stay. That I turned a department on the edge into a place where someone could show up, feel safe, and belong. Now I'm building a program called Staying Power to help girls in the fire service stay long enough to lead. I'm talking to WVU, to chiefs, to anyone who will listen, because this is where the future starts, with mentorship, with culture, with belonging. We say we want more volunteers, then we have to earn them and keep them. We can train anyone to pull a line, but teaching someone they matter, that's the hardest and most sacred part of the job, and I'm not done yet. Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com. That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course, the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this. Your voice matters.